Welcome to AI Talks, the podcast that takes ideas seriously. I'm Paul Lee, senior editor at Engelsberg Ideas, and my guest today is Alwyn Turner, described as Britain's most electrifying contemporary social historian, no less. He's probably best known for his trilogy of books about Britain in the second half of the 20th century, which is Crisis, What Crisis?, Rejoice, Rejoice, and A Classless Society. He also wrote All In It Together, England in the Early 21st Century, which is a Sunday Times book of the year. But we're here to discuss his new work, Little Englanders, Britain in the Edwardian Era. Welcome, Alwyn.
Good morning. Hello.
This strikes me as reading Little Englanders, and it's a terrific read, I have to say. Very stimulating, a wonderful, wonderful portrait of this era, and this striking era. But from the outside, one looks at Edwardian Britain, it's pretty much close to its zenith of imperial power. It's just about the richest place on earth. It's peaceful at this moment. Okay, there's a little thing called the Boer War going on in the first part of this reign, but it's largely peaceful. But it's an age of anxiety. Now, perhaps every age is an age of anxiety, but the Edwardian era seems an acute one. Why is that? What are these anxieties about?
I think it's because there is an awareness, even if it's not entirely conscious, that the country has reached its peak. As you say, it is the richest place in the world, but America has started to overtake it in terms of the size of its economy. And much more worryingly, Germany is now neck and neck and is growing faster than Britain. And I think there is a sense that the 19th century was Britain's century. And the fact that Queen Victoria dies so early at the start of the 20th century, it seems to feel like maybe that era has passed. And as I'm not sure how much of this is conscious, but there is a feeling that it's starting to run out of steam and that others will catch up and indeed are catching up. And one of them is very close, just over the North Sea, and it's a threat.
And that threat has already been established during the Boer War, because Germany is very sympathetic to the Boers, as indeed were many other people. And it highlights all kinds of issues about a rather unhealthy working class population there, a society that is struggling to come to terms with modern warfare. All those anxieties seem to be focused on this conflict in South Africa, where the greatest imperial nation on earth is finding itself challenged by a rather resolute, plucky bunch of farmers of Dutch heritage, which really is kind of pricking away at this vast behemoth that is Imperial Britain.
Yeah, the Boer War is really very disruptive. And obviously from a later viewpoint, it's so overshadowed by the First World War that it's kind of downplayed a bit, I think, in our consciousness. But at the time, it was a really big deal. It was greeted with enthusiasm to start with. And then when it became clear that this wasn't going to be a walkover, and that even when British troops had done what you're supposed to do with an army, they'd taken over all the enemy territory, they'd captured all the main cities and towns, and still the war was not over. It did question the efficacy of the army. And that ultimately is where the power lies. And the idea that this is happening in a part of the empire that should be relatively stable, I think, is disruptive as well. And then there is, as you say, the things like the appalling physical quality of those who volunteered to serve, that people were being turned away in such large numbers because they were unfit, because working class lifestyles were so unhealthy. that produces social change. There is, it seems to impact right across the board with society. The Boer War goes on for so much longer than it should have done by any normal expectations. But it raises queries.
And we see the origins of the welfare state at this period as well, don't we?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, the government that got elected, the Liberal government that got elected in 1906, is one of the great governments. It introduces pensions, it introduces national insurance. This is the foundation of the welfare state. It is a Liberal initiative. And some of that, again, is it goes through because people are aware that things have gone wrong and the Boer War was the canary in the coal mine.
And this welfare state is also a response to Germany's reforms that long predate this, of a more collectivist society.
Yeah, Germany looms very large all the way through this period, I think, as an example of what can be done and sometimes what should not be done. But certainly the welfare reforms that have been introduced by Bismarck were way ahead of anywhere else and made Britain convinced that it needed to catch up there as well as it did on all the other aspects where Germany seemed to be outstripping Britain in terms of naval power and building the army and the economy and everything else. The welfare reforms were seen as part of that overall package that we had to keep pace with this massive rival that was emerging just across the water.
And central to that debate that's happening in society, which is talking about Germany's economy catching up and then surpassing, there's even a kind of moral element here of Germany being in the moral ascendancy even at some point. When you think about what happened with the concentration camps, for example, in South Africa, established by the British, which received massive opprobrium from the rest of the world, not just Germany, but in France, elsewhere too. Lloyd George, the Welsh wizard, is crucial to this, as is another political figure, Joseph Chamberlain, the great mayor of Birmingham, who becomes the great Tory liberal figure who transcends those two boundaries. These are the two great political figures of the age, one senses.
Yes, I think so. And to some extent, the master and the apprentice as well, that Lloyd George had learned so much from Chamberlain. They came from the same kind of low church background. Both of them kind of outsiders in politics, and certainly, as you say, both of them transcend their own parties and split their own parties in due course. Lloyd George will do the same for the Liberals that the Chamberlain did for the Liberals and then the Tories. They are huge figures, and both of them incredibly powerful live speakers at a time when that's the defining characteristic of politics is the platform speech. Both of them absolute masters of it.
And they tread the boards. So there's a part of it that comes over very powerfully in your book, that they are performers. There is something theatrical about both Chamberlain and Lloyd George. And this mirrors something else that's really central to your book. And we've talked about a British working class, unhealthy, lack of nutrition, but also a vibrant working class culture that is centred on the music hall, which is absolutely crucial.
Yes, the music hall is a fascinating subject in its own right. It's the last great entertainment form before recording, and for a historian, that makes it particularly fascinating because it's just on the cusp. There are some records that are made by music hall artists, but they tend to be late in their career when they're not at their peak. And of course, they're very primitive recordings in isolated rooms without an audience. All you get is some kind of vague glimpse of what the reality was, together with the accounts of those who were there. But it was huge. It was the biggest form of live entertainment in the country. And it did shape the politics of the time as well. And I think you're right that Joe Chamberlain and David Lloyd George are both very music hall performers. even though the music hall had no great fondness for Lloyd George because he was seen as being representative of the teetotal movement, which was the antithesis of music hall. But even so, that playing to the crowd is very much part of them. And Chamberlain is the first politician to really understand the power of popular culture, where when he's campaigning for tariff reform, he has a budget to get songs written and performed in music halls to make his political points for him. He's trying to sway the public by using popular culture. And that's something that's become much more common, obviously, but I think he's the first to do so.
And there's something of the dandy about those two as well, isn't there? Because you, when you talk about the dandy, you write very eloquently about Oscar Wilde, those final tragic days of Oscar Wilde. But he remains quite an influential figure in this period, despite the disgrace.
Yes, he kind of hangs over this time. He died in 1900, just a couple of months before Queen Victoria. And the memory of him is certainly there. A very ostentatious kind of 1890s world, which the Edwardians would like to put behind them but can't quite. That's very much part of that as well.
And it's a kind of age of gaiety to a certain extent. I think when we look at it with hindsight, pre-1914, we see the social life as a kind of innocence there. The great short story writer Saki, for example, writes very eloquently about this kind of idyll, this English idyll. I use the word English particularly because it's associated, this age immediately before the First World War, with a kind of pastoral innocence that we see reflected in what I think you call pageantitis, this obsession with folklore that emerges, this obsession with folk music, this idea that England is being lost, because it's predominantly by now, I think it's something like over 75% of the population lives in urban areas, which, as you say, have improved little since the day of Dickens. There is still great squalor, as the Boer War evidenced in terms of the state of the troops that were conscripted for that. And this is really productive in terms of, and I think particularly of the music of this period, the classical music of this period, a bit like George Butterworth, Vaughan Williams, Elgar, many others, who are tapping in to this deep, rich seam of folk music and folk traditions.
Yes, and again, I think this is largely to do with the end of the century as well. The 19th century, people were aware of just how extraordinary it was, how much had changed, how much had the face of the nation had been completely transformed over that period. And there is a very big move, starts in the late 19th century, but reaches its peak in the early 20th century, of trying to recapture what was there before and hopefully preserve it before it finally disappears. And you're right, it produces some extraordinary music. I mean, Britain is not one of the great musical nations of Europe, but it is probably the high point of concert music. And it does produce Elgar, who is the greatest of all the composers. And it also produces some very serious literature. I mean, Thomas Hardy has finished writing novels by this stage, but his poetry is again tapping into that pastoral Englishness that I think, again, it's not a rejection of industrialization and urbanization, but it is an attempt to recapture what was there. And to preserve. And you can see that with the rise of the National Trust and bodies like this that are also trying to preserve the heritage, the built heritage and the natural heritage of the country.
Which is a kind of response to a fear of something being lost. It's again going back to this age of anxiety that we have, this acute age of anxiety, I'd argue. But because, you know, famously the Germans had called England Das Land ohne Musik, the land without music. And this, in a sense, was a response to the dominance of, again, German culture within Britain. But let's talk about, let's go back to the power of people in the music hall. Because I was thinking about this with resonances to, say, the Beatles, even. I was listening to Sergeant Pepper quite recently, discussing it with a historian friend of mine who was arguing that it was almost Dickensian and Edwardian in much of its flavour, Sergeant Pepper, if you even look at the cover. The Beatles are dressed in Edwardian clothes, or what Macmillan would have called Edwardian, of course. But it's... there is a much greater continuity, I think, in British culture than we often realise, that much of what we think of as popular culture that we think began in the late 1950s or early 60s actually has a much longer origin, much more distant origin. And this is why I think the music hall still resonates. There's something very musical about the Beatles. We think of something, you know, for the benefit of Mr. Kite song, which is explicit about the music hall and that kind of nostalgia for it. But if we look at...
When I'm 64, is a straightforward music hall song, really.
Absolutely. And these...
I think that's the... Music hall runs right the way through the classic years of British rock music.
Yeah.
It's there in the 60s. In
the Kinks, people
you,
like that.
You have Herman's Hermits having a number one hit in America with I'm Henry VIII, I Am, an old Harry Champion song from 1910 or whenever.
Yeah.
But it's also there in the 1970s. David Bowie is a music hall performer.
Yeah.
The Sex Pistols are probably the last of the great music hall acts. That runs right the way through. And I think a large part of that is because although the music hall in its pure form died during the First World War, the memory of it was still there. And if you were growing up in the 1950s and 60s, those songs, My Old Dutch and Down at the Old Bull and Bush and all the rest of them, they were still part of television entertainment.
Yeah.
That was part of the culture, part of the warp and weft of everyday society. They have an extraordinarily long life and do shape what comes next, yeah.
And you feature the great figures of the music hall here, none greater, I suppose, than Mary Lloyd, who is an absolute giant of the age in terms of what we would now call celebrity, a superstar, and an influential political figure too, as we see this emergence of the working class, the lower middle class, as a real political force.
Yeah, Murray Lloyd is the greatest of them all. The closest that this country ever had to a Marilyn Monroe figure, I think. And remains true to her roots all the way through. At a time when the music hall is becoming more respectable, more acceptable in polite society, Murray Lloyd keeps true to the working class roots of the form and is much, much loved as a result.
And the earnings that these people make, you know, people like Murray Lloyd, people like Little Titch, who seems very much a novelty act to us, but who was absolutely huge at the time, and George Formby Sr., not the George Formby of the risque lyric that we know of from the 1930s and 40s, but his father, who was an extraordinary and tragic figure.
He was just George Formby, as he was known at the time. He had the senior attached to him later
on.
But yes, he was the Wigan Nightingale, he was known as. And he has this wonderfully cracked voice. And the recordings that survive of him are really quite impressive. He kind of mumbles away during the bits in between the singing, because most of the comedy at the time is song-based. But there is starting to emerge the idea of patter between verses, which will later turn into what we think of now as stand-up comedy. And George Formby is there doing that, doing songs that are just tragically optimistic, given what a shabby figure he cut on stage himself. And the fact that he was just so racked with appalling lung conditions. I mean, he would burst out coughing heavily during his act, and had this catchphrase of "coughing well tonight," just turning it into a joke. And that laughing in the face of adversity is absolutely crucial to what the music hall did, and I think crucial to understanding British culture and British values in life.
And there was political,
the idea that the comedy is the default setting.
And there was
culture.
Political and social commentary here as well, wasn't there?
Yeah, I mean, they are documenting the state of the housing and poor nutrition and all the rest of it is all there in the songs. It tends to be treated with a degree of humour because this is supposed to be appealing to a live audience of people who know the truth.
Yeah.
They experience it directly, but they're out on a Saturday night wanting to have a drink and a laugh. So you're reflecting their life back to them, but with a sense of forbearance, of acceptance in the face of adversity. It's remarkably appealing, and I think is part of why it has lasted so long, and why it shapes generations who were born after the musical was already finished.
Now, one of the things
that's still there.
Now, one of the things I noticed, Alwyn, is I associate the music hall to a certain extent with jingoism, and jingoism is very much this phenomenon that takes off during the Edwardian era. But actually, it's a much more critical age than we think it is. I was very taken, for example, by the figure of Cecil Rhodes, extraordinary man, whatever one thinks of his morality, a man of extraordinary energy, his huge projects in Africa that I suppose are akin to what China's doing now, I suppose, in terms of imperialism. But he's not a figure without criticism at that time. And in fact, you argue, and very convincingly, I think, that he was never really accepted by the British public, fated as this simplistic hero, because he was too much like a Napoleon, a Bonaparte. He was too massive a figure, in a way, for the British people to accept him. And I think, despite there are many books written at the moment about how important imperialism is in defining the British during this period, during the Edwardian period. And yet, in fact, in many ways, they were quite reluctant imperialists, the working class, the middle classes.
I think they're not that much interested, to be honest. That's it is surprising how little, for example, of the music hall songs, how few of them have any reference to empire or to the colonies.
Yeah.
It's simply not part of the cultural landscape for most people. It is simply there. That's the backdrop, but it doesn't need any discussion in the same way that natural features don't need any discussion. It is just the world that exists. Rhodes is, yeah, there's a lot of criticism of Rhodes at the time. He is not seen as a heroic figure. And some of that is because he is so remote an ascetic. Mm. He doesn't play games. He doesn't hunt. He doesn't do any of the things that you would expect an English gentleman to do.
Yeah.
He doesn't behave in the same way as colonialists normally do. His interest is in power and in the money that will get him the power and in expanding the empire as much as possible. And it all seems to be so heavily bound up in his own self-image and his own sense of importance that it's a difficult one to cope with. It's not how Britain likes to see itself. There's no sense of modesty or self-effacement about Rhodes. It's a form of self-aggrandizement that does not sit well.
I want to move on to another thing that has proved lasting about the Edwardian era, which remains with us to this day, and that's the popular press, the one newspaper, I think, that's associated with the Edwardian era and still very powerful today and criticised in similar terms is the Daily Mail, which is symbolic of an entire new culture of newspapers, of journalism. You have a wonderful quote from Lord Salisbury, who one might argue was the last properly conservative prime minister of the of Britain. He describes the Daily Mail as a paper for those who could read but could not think. And you could imagine one of our bien-pensant thinkers making exactly that same statement today. But it's also reflective, again, of this emergence of a new middle class, a more powerful, more articulate middle class and working class.
And of course, that was where the future of the Conservative Party was going to lie.
Indeed.
I mean, Salisbury is reflecting an old Tory tradition. And to some extent, that attitude of Salisbury is what runs through the Conservative Party in this period, is a fear of democratisation. Mm-hmm. I mean, as it turns out, as we see after the First World War, when the franchise is massively expanded, it does the Tories no harm whatsoever. They are capable of adjusting to this new world, but they are very fearful of it. And it's another part of the anxiety that runs through this time, is that the Conservative Party wishes to stop the clock, it feels. It does not want to go any further down this path of democratisation. The Labour Party is starting to get MPs elected. Who knows what the future will bring? And as I say, all of that turns out to be misplaced because the future brings more and more Conservative governments. But there is this suspicion of it. And as you say, the press is really important at this stage. The Daily Mail becomes the first paper to get 1 million circulation. And it does transform what we think of as the press. It is an extraordinary institution. And the fact that that survives as well and has thrived through all the changes that have happened is an impressive achievement.
And what is it about the Daily Mail? What does the Daily Mail do that makes it so successful and its contemporaries as well?
The Mail, primarily, it's created by Alfred Harmsworth, and it is made in his image. And he sees himself as being an absolutely ordinary, typical member of the British population, and therefore his prejudices will be those that are shared by others. And he articulates that through the papers. His version of a newspaper is not lengthy, massive reports from Parliament of what people have said. It is about what people, his readers, are thinking, in his estimation at least. And the sales figure suggests he's right, that he's interested in articulating what the readers think rather than giving them information from on high. It is part of that process of people demanding that their voices be heard. And the Mail represents a huge swathe of opinion in the country that hadn't previously had the chance to express itself as an opinion.
And how would you characterise those opinions?
They're curiously mixed. There's a resistance to social developments. The Mail is not a fan of the introduction of pensions. It swings wildly on issues of tariff reform. But it also embraces technology. It's contradictory at times. Social progress is seen as being something to be suspicious of, but technological process is embraced. Harmsworth is a massive fan of aviation. Mm-hmm. There's a kind of a curious mix, which I think is, again, reflective of how people are. No, people don't stay to a fixed agenda. Everybody has this confusion of ideas, and Harmsworth did more than almost anybody. He's a traditionalist, but he doesn't fit easily into any political party.
So in that sense, he's a little bit like Chamberlain and Lloyd George, who are these figures of the age.
Yeah, They're probably the biggest, I mean, and certainly in political terms, these are the biggest figures of the time. And the fact that a newspaper proprietor has made himself a creature who can be compared to a prime minister, or in Chamberlain's case, somebody who everybody expected to be prime minister, that's a change in the nature of the press as well. That's an involvement, and a direct involvement, that was to become even more apparent in the 1920s and 30s with the great era of the press barons. But he's the first of them. Not literally, he's not the first newspaper proprietor to get a peerage, but he is the first of the that new breed of press baron that will seek political influence directly. That's a different move as well.
And the press plays a really important role in what you make the case for, and I think very convincingly again, as one of the most revealing episodes of the age. And that's the Crippen case, where a lot of, which is all over the newspapers, and which also encapsulates all the anxieties of the age in one. Why is that? What is it about the case about Crippen, the Crippen murder, that really encapsulates and symbolises the Edwardian age?
I think it's the sheer banality of it,
Well, just tell
almost.
us about the case
So
first,
the
just a little sketch of it.
Crippen was is an American homeopath who lived in North London. He was married to an American woman who was herself a music hall performer, not one of the big stars, but she was around and she was known. And Crippen was found guilty of having murdered her, having poisoned her and then dismembered the body, most of which was never found, and then fleeing with his lover, who had been his secretary, and fleeing first to the continent and then getting a ship to Canada, by which time it was known, the captain of the ship had his suspicions aroused and had telegraphed ashore to Scotland Yard to say that he thought he had Crippen on board. And Scotland Yard detective chased after in another ship, 2 days behind, but going faster, and managed to arrest Crippen and his lover as they arrived in Canada. And it was covered very heavily by the press all the way through this chase. As soon as Crippen disappeared from London, it was assumed that he was guilty. And the papers every single day for a couple of weeks were following this chase across the Atlantic and the search for Crippen. And it becomes the biggest murder story of the time, even though as a crime, it is so ordinary
It's
in
quite
so many
banal, isn't it,
ways.
really?
This is a man kills his wife because he's in love with a younger woman. It's not unusual. But I think that's part of it, is in a world that has reshaped itself towards the ordinary,
Yeah.
the fact that Crippen is so ordinary is what elevates him above the crowd, as it
It's a
were. It encapsulates the rottenness of respectability,
Yeah,
almost.
it's
That
a
this this
murder for
is
a more democratic age in a way, isn't it, you could say?
yeah, and it's in the suburbs. It feels like it ought to be perfectly respectable, proper, upright kind of world. And yet within that, there are the remains of a wife buried in the cellar, rotting at the very foundations of this bourgeois suburban establishment.
And it
It
focuses all these anxieties, doesn't it, about the
yeah.
United States, about technology, about democracy, even about the music hall.
Yes, the fact that she was on the musical stage does help part, as part of the excitement of the story. I mean, the fact that Crippen probably didn't kill his wife was not something anybody wished to consider at the time. It was the story was so great that it becomes He's described as one of the great monsters of all time. It is a domestic murder. These are tragically very common. But he's elevated to this status as a symbol of his time.
Another symbol of the time, who gives his name to this era, is the king. Mm. Edward VII, son of Victoria, who, and there are some parallels to this, I suppose, has been waiting quite a long while to take that throne.
The longest serving Prince of Wales at the time, I believe.
Indeed. And what does he lend to the age? I mean, one thing that I think we can say that's concrete is his love affair with France. He's a great fan of Gallic gaiety, we might say. And the Entente Cordiale, of course, comes together as a response in part against the rise of Germany and fears about that. How does he characterise the age as he does? He's not a hugely prominent figure in your book.
He's not. I think it's more that he's a reaction to Victoria.
Mm.
Victoria was loved and respected and venerated, but she was a remote figure for the last couple of decades. And Edward is this very ebullient, large character, has something of the atmosphere of Henry VIII and John Bull and that kind of characteristic, I mean, the physical shape of the archetypal Englishman. That kind of helps. He looks very well upholstered. And he embraces popular culture. He's a big fan of the music hall, even though he doesn't actually go to one. He has music hall performers come and perform for him. And he seems to represent an unbuttoning of the time. Again, a reaction against the Victorian world. There's a sense that we've gone as far as we possibly can down that road of Victorian values shaped by the evangelical movement.
Yeah.
And maybe it wasn't quite sufficient. The idea that we need a bit more emotion, we need a bit more sentiment in society. He seemed more in tune with that than the slightly austere figure of Victoria.
And perhaps more at one with a increasingly democratic age?
Yes, and as you said, with the whole Entente Cordiale was incredibly important. I mean, he does play a key role in this. Obviously, the work has to be done by diplomats and everybody else negotiating the agreements between Britain and France. But the fact that it's happening, that Britain's old enemy is now to become an ally against Germany, which traditionally had been a British ally, mm-hmm. That takes a big shift in public consciousness to recognise that actually things have changed and we need to be closer to France. That's made possible by Edward VII's embrace of the country, I think.
Though even though he makes that possible, the alliance with France, France brings its own baggage in the shape of Russia. And there's much greater antipathy to the idea of an alliance with Russia.
Russia has never enjoyed any popularity in British culture. It has always been seen as a backward, reactionary, almost medieval country that doesn't quite belong, and a cruel country. And it seems to many British people the antithesis of Britishness. But, as you say, France has an alliance with Russia. We enter an alliance with France, and then that's the obvious next step, is that we should ally ourselves to Russia as well. But it's not a comfortable thing for the British. They've grown up distrusting Russia, distrusting the autocracy of the place. And it's not... They're not the people that we would wish necessarily to be allies with.
And
but it is accepted.
And there's real evidence, there's physical evidence of what we might call Russian cruelty in the Jewish immigrants into Britain who are escaping pogroms in the East. There is virulent anti-Semitism against them here. But to a certain extent, that is tempered by the antipathy to Russia.
Yes, I think as an abstract, people will be supportive of those who have been persecuted by the Russian state. The reality of mass Jewish immigration into the East End of London was also resented. Those two things kind of went hand in hand and didn't seem to conflict in most in the general perception of the time. But there was certainly a great deal of hostility towards Jewish immigration at the turn of the century, and the passing of laws to curb it.
And concern about immigration is quite strong. One of the most striking statistics in your book is the fact that I think it's 96% of people in Britain were born here, according to the 1901 census. That's an extraordinary figure. That's not what one expects if one reads a number of contemporary historians who talk about the fact that immigration has always been part of British culture. But that's not really the case, I think, in the modern sense. And so the Jews in the East End of London are really quite novel in a way.
Yes, and the fact that at that stage it was a very concentrated population, a very small area. That was new. The idea that there was a part of London that seemed to have been taken over, to use the expression that was being used at the time. And I think that's, the fact that the population is not one of immigrants is possibly also part of why, to go back to what we were talking about earlier, the empire doesn't really have a great deal of resonance.
Yeah, there's very little evidence at home of it, really, I suppose.
Yeah, you simply do not see people who are not British. Mm. It is a rare thing.
Oh, it's very interesting, and not really what we would expect. But I think the overwhelming feeling when I finished your book, it's a tremendous read, and I read it very quickly because it's such a great, rousing narrative, really, is that it's at the point where it's more about what is to come. We think about H.G. Wells, for example, as one of the great authors of this period, predicting what will come. We think of Erskine Childers' Riddle of Sands, for example, about what is to come in terms of fear of German invasion, in fear of technological advance, whatever. H.G. Wells' War of the Worlds. But by the end of your story, certainly by the end of the Edwardian era, these things haven't yet come about and yet are absolutely central to the public and political narratives that are going on there. So we have these new waves of women's suffrage, campaigns for women's suffrage. We have this nascent, emerging labour movement that's increasingly important, but not yet in power. We've got unrest in Ireland, but still not explicit, as it becomes in 1916. And so there's this kind of cloud over the country without resolution by the time that war breaks out in 1914.
The outbreak of war interrupts so much of that. The number of strikes reduces massively as soon as war breaks out. The women's suffrage movement puts itself on hold for the duration of hostilities. The Irish Home Rule Bill is passed and then immediately deferred so that it won't yet be implemented. And part of the problem with writing something like this is it is impossible not to be aware that 1914 is coming, and just how massive and significant 1914 is in the history of certainly of European culture and possibly of the world, and trying to get some sense of how it felt when you didn't know that. But even without that knowledge, it still feels as if at the time people knew that there was a rupture coming. Things were changing very rapidly, not technologically so much as socially and politically, that the strains were there, and it could all end in disaster.
And there's one technology there that also fits into this mould, I think, and something we still talk about today in terms of its effects, and that's the motor car, of course.
Yes, I mean, the advent of the car does change so much in this. It's still a minority pursuit. But during this period, Ford opened their first production line in Britain. And that also is part of why people are feeling that maybe industrialization has obliterated too much of the past, and we need to recapture a pre-industrial world, because the Ford Motor Works is, it's just this huge symbolic shift to a mechanized world that is completely alien to where we have been before.
And we have, of course, the first traffic accident as well.
As soon as you get the cars, you're going to get the accidents and the first fatality and the first speeding fine, and the attempt to try to control this. And it is, as I say, it's still a very much a minority pursuit. The horse is still the dominant form of transport, but things are changing. And with that, you also get the destruction of geography. Distance no longer matters in the same way. Which produces a change in how people think about the country.
And ironically, the coming of the motor car opens up the country, this industrialised, very urban country. It opens it up with various guides to the countryside. It fetishises almost this disappearing countryside for those who reside in urban or suburban areas.
Yes, you can actually drive out into the country for the day in a way that you wouldn't have been able to with a horse and cart. You can actually get out, celebrate it, and then return to the city again. And it does. Alongside that, I think the development in recording technology is really important as well, as this part of this new mechanized age. The gramophone does exist. The cinema does exist. They're very primitive by comparison with what's going to come later. But that idea of fixed recordings of cultural work that is not dependent upon an interaction with an audience, that's a huge cultural shift that I think we've lived with all our lives, and we're not therefore always aware of just how big this jump is. It flattens regional variations.
Yep.
It flattens national variations. You know, I mean, we have films coming from France and from America, and they are not dependent upon an audience's response. This is already recorded and fixed in a way that a play cannot be, or a musical performance cannot be. There is something about that that changes the psychology of how we consume culture.
And of course, that culture is becoming increasingly popular. And there is a sense in which, and it's referred to by politicians, that the 19th century was a period of wealth accumulation. The 20th century is going to be the century in which that wealth is distributed more fairly, where there is greater democracy, there is greater access to political power for more people. But there's also, I think, anxiety about that wealth. And we live with this idea today that we can only have a fully working welfare state, an NHS, all kinds of schemes that we'd love to have at the highest level, but we can't do it if we don't create the wealth. And I thought one of the most telling quotes in your book, still resonant today, came from that disparaged figure, even at the time, Cecil Rhodes. And when he said, "It is no use for us to have big ideas if we've not got the money to carry them out." And I thought that that remained as resonant now as it did then.
Yeah, I think that's probably true. And to some extent, that does encapsulate the period. It is, we can build the welfare state. We can start this process because Britain is still one of the great industrial powerhouses of the world. And the fact that we are copying Germany, which is our closest rival,
yeah,
that seems appropriate as well. That's the direction of travel.
Well, Alwyn, you've written a tremendous book. I think it's a really thrilling survey of of Britain in a state of flux, I suppose we'd call it. And it's that very lack of hindsight. We, the reader, brings hindsight to it, but the book does not. It's very much in its time. It's from the viewpoint of people living through this extraordinary era. And I can't recommend the book enough. It's called Little Englanders, Britain in the Edwardian Era. It's by Alwyn Turner, and it's published by Profile, and it's out now. So thank you for giving us this survey. There is, of course, so much more in the book, which I highly recommend. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
This podcast was brought to you by the Axel and Margaret Axon Johnson Foundation.